This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Founder Symposium. I am Lauren Reynolds, and as a UC San Diego alumna, I am truly honored to be able to take part in this event tonight. This is the third year I've done this, and in the past, I have found the speakers to be phenomenal. I'm sure tonight will be no different. UC San Diego was a wonderful place to study as an undergraduate. It affected my life in many ways. The most basic way is it brought me from LA, where I grew up, to San Diego. And it'll be no surprise to many of you that I never went home, right? A lot of us stay here. It was at UC San Diego that I developed a true love of history and of writing. When I was an undergraduate, my job was actually as a writing tutor here on campus. Through career services, I got my first internship at a small public access television station in Del Mar. And because of that, I was able to launch a television news reporting career that spanned 17 years. I now still live in San Diego, even though I retired from the news, and I own a home health agency and a home care agency. And that has been shaped my work ethic and my background by my experiences at UC San Diego. And it's great to be able to be local and to take part in events like this tonight. Tonight, you will hear from six outstanding faculty members who will highlight the life-changing research, education, and public service happening every day here at UC San Diego, and each will share the inspiration for why they do what they do. Before we begin, it is my pleasure to introduce UC San Diego's 8th Chancellor, Pradeep K. Khosla. Upon his appointment in 2012, he led our campus in developing our first ever strategic plan, which has sharpened our mission and vision as a student-centered, research-focused, service-oriented public university and paved the way for a bright future for UC San Diego. Please welcome Chancellor Pradeep Khosla.
Thank you, Lauren, and welcome, everybody. Welcome to our Founder Symposium. This is an amazing day, or it's an amazing set of days, the whole weekend, where it has become a tradition for this campus to celebrate our founding, to celebrate our founders, many of who are still around, and to look back and see the great things that we have done. It's actually unbelievable to realize that we were founded in 1960, which is only 54 years ago, and I joke about the fact that we are younger than I am. I mean, this could be on the Big Bang Theory, and it would be a joke as to you'll be younger than yourself. But we are younger than I am. And in those 54 years, we've had an amazing track record of accomplishment. We've had 18 Nobel laureates grace our halls and our buildings and have been on our faculty. We've had 18 National Medal of Science winners on our faculty. We are ranked like number 6 in the country in terms of National Academy members. We are ranked like number 5 in terms of $1 billion-plus research portfolio. And this last one is not insignificant. It is the hard work of every faculty member in an extremely competitive environment that gets us this research productivity, which is $1 billion. The UC system on the average gets about 10% of all federal research, and we get about 20% of the UC system's federal research. So we are about 1/5 of the UC system's portfolio. So you can see that we are about 2% of the national research portfolio in the country. And this research funding leads to some really great outcomes. And you will hear from 6 of our great faculty members today. And I'll let Suresh talk about it. But let me tell you, when I got here, one of the first things we did was talk about doing a strategic planning exercise. And as we went through that and obtained input from more than 10,000 people, what emerged were 4 themes and about 13 strategies and 5 goals. And we are slowly but steadily investing in every one of those. And every one of you, whether you work here or you're a member of the community, you are a part of the plan and you're helping us achieve the plan. So if you're a Chancellor's Associate member, you're helping us achieve the plan. If you're not, then you will be by tomorrow and help us achieve the plan. So with that said, I'm going to introduce our Executive Vice Chancellor, the man who's responsible for keeping intact the brain trust and giving me good advice, Suresh Subramani.
Good Well, thank you, Pradeep. I just work here. I've worked here for 32 years, and I'm proud of continuing that tradition. Thanks again for the great turnout. It's wonderful to see many familiar faces, and I'm sure you're in for a very exciting evening this evening. So this is our annual tradition of the Founders Symposium that we started 4 years ago, but it gives us the ability and opportunity to honor some of the exciting interdisciplinary work that has been going on campus. And in this sense, it continues a tradition established by our founders when they established this particular university. We believe that here at UC San Diego, we are all about creating and applying new knowledge that changes the world. And in doing so, we fulfill our mission of being a public research and teaching university. So as Pradeep said, through the strategic planning process, four research themes came out that really cut across the entire campus. And so what we wanted to see is the ability of every faculty member to look at these four research themes and see an opportunity for them to participate directly in this. So I'm going to give you a brief summary of what these four themes are, and you'll hear about two of them in more detail this evening. So the first theme, and I'm going to start with the two that we're not going to talk about today or focus on tonight. Now, the first theme is one that explores the basis of human knowledge and creativity. And so what is this theme particularly about? So this idea here behind this is to understand the neurological and cultural basis of things like cognition, communication, and expression. And in fact, this campus and our faculty were instrumental in developing what's called the Brain Initiative that was initiated by President Obama. And then the state of California also has created a new initiative called CalBrain. And as I said, our faculty members wrote the white papers that drove this whole enterprise at the federal level as well as the state level. And we're doing some very exciting things on the campus as a result of this. This theme also explores the human experience through bringing together the sciences, the arts, the humanities, and social sciences in a way that really addresses key problems having to do with knowledge, the communication, creativity, and so on, and to really use this as a framework for policy decisions as well as understanding human organization and behavior. The second theme, again, one we're not going to talk about today, is understanding cultures and addressing disparities in society. All of you know, of course, that we have a huge number of inequalities and disparities in society. So this is about trying to understand diverse human cultures and social behaviors and modes of self-expression. It is also to identify the origins of different kinds of inequalities that pervade our society. And the idea here is to use this information to correct these inequalities that exist, whether it is in health or education or political enfranchisement or even financial resources that are available to individuals across not just the people in the United States but across the whole world. And we hope that this really impacts the things that affect society in a broad sense. It is also to develop and policy and ethical guidelines that guide our thinking and behavior as we deal with complex problems around the whole world. The third theme, and this is one that you will hear about today, is understanding and protecting the planet. And, of course, this is to understand things like the climate and our ecosystems and how best to protect them. And you all know that these are all endangered in multiple ways. And many of these are due to our own actions as humans try to exploit resources that exist on the planet. It is also about dealing with environmental change and the effects of environmental change on human health and cultures and trying to develop sustainable practices to help us live in the next 50, 100 years to make sure that what we leave for the next generation is better than what we have today. And finally, the fourth theme is to enrich human life and society. And here the theme is about improving human health. And, of course, we benefit here on this campus by having health sciences along with Scripps Institution of Oceanography as well as the general campus. And so this brings together all of the assets that we have to bear on this particular problem of human health and trying to improve society. And intrinsic in this is also trying to bring together the various disciplines that exist on campus to create solutions to medical problems, to develop engineering solutions to the problems that we have in society, as well as educational solutions to serve society in a broad sense. And of course, immersed in this is the idea of that there are both positive and negative impacts of technology, and we want to try and understand this. So with these four themes in mind, we've invested a substantial amount in as part of our strategic plan in trying to foster these different research teams. We've invested in a big way in getting new faculty here, but we've also invested in resources for students, and as well as this includes graduate students, and postdocs, to try and facilitate the research that will allow us to really crack these problems. So I hope you had an opportunity to see the posters presented by some of our undergraduates, but you will also recognize that what the faculty will present today cannot be driven without the students. So the students play a very integral part in this whole thing, and ultimately these will be the ambassadors that go out and speak on our behalf and take our message to the rest of the world. So I hope you can look forward to an enjoyable time, and I'll turn this back to Lauren to kick off the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chancellor Khosla and Executive Vice Chancellor Subramani. Now, let's get started with the program. There are major challenges facing the world today as associated with changes in global climate. These changes have far-reaching implications for weather patterns, ecosystems, and economies. Rigorous scientific analysis must assess the risks, uncertainty, and opportunities clearly. UC San Diego researchers seek to understand the environment on all spatial and temporal scales, enable effective use of that knowledge, and engineer solutions in global societies. At the same time, finding feasible and effective measures to respond to environmental risks requires fresh thinking about political, economic, and social forces that determine our set of choices. You might think about the global climate system as comprised of three components: the ocean-atmosphere system, natural and human infrastructure that we are interested in protecting, and the forces at work that can drive changes in the climate system. The real system is very complex, with all of these components closely interconnected and affecting each other. Some of the challenges that we're facing are associated with uncertainty in our understanding of this system and in defining the associated risks. One of the objectives for research is to convert this uncertainty to predictive capacity and to identify opportunities for solutions. Our first group of speakers will describe some of the work being carried out here at UC San Diego that is expanding our understanding of the global climate system. Dr. Matthew Alford from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography will talk about how internal waves in the ocean affect how we are able to constrain uncertainty in our climate predictions. Dr. Gino Pollack from the Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering Department will describe how our understanding of physical processes plays an essential role in assessing risks for ecosystems like coral reefs. Dr. Richard Carson from the Department of Economics will address how research on economic systems is creating opportunities for reductions in emissions to minimize effects on climate. So before they begin, let me tell you a little bit about each speaker. Matthew Alford is an alumnus. He's a professor of physical oceanography at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. His research group, aptly named Wave Chasers, travels the world building and deploying high-tech robotic systems to detect and measure skyscraper-sized internal gravity waves as they move across the world's oceans. Tonight, he'll introduce these waves, describe the technology used to observe them, and discuss their primary impacts, interfering with submarine navigation, divers, and offshore structures, fueling biological production and redistributing algae and larvae by transporting ocean nutrients into shallow coastal regions, and predicting climate change in conjunction with computer simulations of the ocean. Alumnus Gina Pollack is an associate professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering. His research focuses on understanding the physical dynamics of environmental systems, specifically on connections between the coast and open space. From an engineering perspective, this research has implications for predicting storm surge, tsunami inundation, water quality, and coastal erosion. Tonight, you'll hear how his experiences as a surfer and sandcastle builder growing up on the coast of Panama spurred his interest in this path of inquiry. Richard Carson is a professor of economics, a longtime UC San Diego faculty member. His recent work has focused on forecasting Chinese carbon dioxide emissions, quantifying the benefits of major changes to British water quality regulations, examining the labor market impacts of widespread arsenic contamination of shallow tube wells in rural Bangladesh, looking at the role incentives play in the purchase of new electric vehicles in California, and preserving a large tropical rainforest in Malaysia. Please welcome Matthew Alford to get the program started.
Hi, everyone. So yeah, as I've been introduced, I'm an alum, and I'm going to tell you about some things that you've probably never even heard of. In fact, raise your hand, don't be shy, raise your hand if you've ever heard of an internal wave. Wow, that's actually amazing. And the rest of you, don't be shy, you'll know what an internal wave is by the end of the talk. Walter, you've heard of internal waves. I remember seeing internal waves for the first time. I had no idea what they were when I was a prospective graduate student at Scripps in Rob Pinkel's lab. And I saw these displays on the screen. I had no idea what they were, but I knew somehow that I wanted to study them, and that's what I've been doing for the past long time. This you can make these waves at home. Internal waves exist any time that you have denser fluid below lighter fluid, and you have something to set them in motion. So what my graduate student Maddie Heyman did is she made this nicely colored tank where we just have water and oil. You can do this at home. And if I set this in motion, you can see that the waves between the between the two layers form these beautiful waves. And what you can see is that they can travel around. They're much larger than they would be on the surface. They're just like the waves you see breaking on beaches. But because these density differences in the ocean are so much smaller, they can be huge, as big as skyscrapers, as I've argued. And I'll show you lots of stuff that will... That will convince you. I find my title completely outrageous. I actually find it amazing, some of the claims that I make in this talk. I mean, how can waves that we've never even heard of actually impact submarines and have something to do with the climate or coastal ecosystems? And all of that turns out really to be true. What I'm showing in this slide is actually data. It's not a computer simulation. And this is looking down at the Earth. NASA has a ton of satellites. And this one is measuring the sea surface height. This is work by my former postdoc, Songzhang Zhao, at University of Washington. And what we're plotting is the crests and troughs of internal waves, the surface part of internal waves, north of Hawaii and south from the Aleutian Range. And what we can see is that there's these very special regions in the ocean that where the tides are flowing back and forth past seafloor bumps, and it makes these waves. These waves have horizontal wavelengths of 160 kilometers or so. And the amazing thing about these waves is that they can propagate all the way across oceans. And one of the big themes of our current research is, where do they go? Where do they actually break? Because that's a key aspect of internal waves, as you saw from from the tank. You can see that these waves can sweep dense water up above lighter water, which is unstable, and you get turbulence. And that turbulence is what's responsible for bringing up nutrients from the deep sea for ecosystems, and it's what is responsible for redistributing heat in the ocean, which has these impacts on climate that we'll be talking about. Now, when we step forward and we see where do these waves wind up, some of these waves from Hawaii actually wind up on our beach. And you can see this photo here. We're all used to kind of gazing out at the sea in San Diego and seeing the surface waves breaking on the beach. But what you can see in this is much more regular, much more broadly spaced lines slowly coming in. And if this were a video, you'd see these lines slowly coming in towards shore. These are the surface signatures of internal waves, and you've all seen them on calm summer days here. And these are the waves I'm talking about, the surface part. Now, if you look at what these waves are beneath the sea, you need specialized equipment. So what we've seen so far, that photo is actually snapped by somebody in the audience, Dr. Jen McKinnon. She's a professor at Scripps. And you can see those. The one before that was looked downwards on the Earth from satellites. But to really get underneath the sea, you need these specialized instruments. And that's the kind of things that we've been working on for many, many years to push forward this technology. Some of these profilers were developed at University of Washington and actually originally here at University of California, San Diego, Scripps by Mike Gregg and his advisor, Chip Cox. Some of them we've developed at University of Washington and we continue to develop here at Scripps. Some of them are, so this one, for example, here is a robotic crawler. So you put a mooring out and it actually goes up and down on its own making measurements of the waves. And so you can see, you can measure the passage and the vertical motion of the layers of the ocean with these instruments. And we watch, what we typically do is we put arrays of these instruments out and we watch the waves go past. Okay, so now this is what the waves would actually look like with one of these instruments. And so what I'm showing in this upper left panel is a figure very similar to what I saw many, many years ago in Rob Pinkel's office. And so it's a bunch of wavy lines that may not make a lot of sense to you, and I'll just do my best to kind of make it make sense. What I'm showing is warm water is red, cold water is blue. And this is measured from a mooring that we had off of the Washington coast, where we had very, very dense measurements sampling every 3 seconds. You have to sample very fast to catch these waves. And what we see is the surface is at the top, the bottom about 100 meters or 300 feet down is at the bottom. And I'm plotting about an hour of data from the mooring. So what you can see is you can see that these waves sweep the warm water downwards and then back up again. And if we zoom in on the first one of these waves, now we're only plotting about 10 minutes. And you can see that these waves are very, very sharp. And so the water that was originally at about 30 feet depth or 10 meters depth has now been swept down in the course of 1 to 2 minutes to over 120 feet. So if you were a scuba diver or a submarine captain, you'd be very, very unhappy about that situation. And in fact, I was just invited to be an expert witness on for a lawsuit where a diver in Tahiti has gotten the bends by having been swept downward by one of these waves. So these are a big deal, and so that's why the Navy is very interested in this research, because you want a prediction system for these waves so that submarines can avoid them. Now this, I mentioned earlier how that the waves are set in motion by the tides as they flow over seafloor bumps. This is a simulation by somebody else in the audience, Ruth Musgrave. She's a graduate student at Scripps. And so she set up this computer simulation where she has the tides flowing back and forth over a seafloor bump. So what you can see is as the tides go this way, the layers of the ocean, which are indicated in black, are swept up and over the ridge and downwards, and then they form waves, which can then radiate away. Also importantly, the waves get very jagged in the near field, which means that you're having that dense water swept up above lighter water, and you get this turbulence. The wind is another big source of internal waves, which I'm not talking about in that example, but big storms can generate internal waves as well. Now, this is another really important result by another graduate student, Caitlin Whalen, who's also in the audience at Scripps. And what she's done here is she's plotted a map of the turbulence or the mixing, how much of that dense water is being exchanged with lighter water above that would happen due to these breaking internal waves in the ocean. And this is not direct measurements, but it's an estimate of how much turbulence there would be if internal waves do what we think they should do in the ocean. And the take-home message here is that orange areas of the ocean are very, very turbulent. Blue and green areas are much, much less turbulent. And so what we see is that some areas of the ocean are 100 times more turbulent than other areas that are quiet. This turns out to be very important. And here I really want to acknowledge, again, Professor McKinnon, who has led this thing called a climate processes team. And, you know, we've all been making measurements of these internal waves for many, many years, but it's really Jen who's made the climate community, the modelers, aware of the importance of these waves. And so I'll show that with this slide. This is a plot of sea level over the past from 1800 to 2100. And on the left-hand side of the slide, it's measurements. And so we can see this is the measurements, and the uncertainty gets less and less as our measurements get better and better. So now the dashed line is present day, and then on the right-hand side, these are predictions from various climate models that we have. Now you can see all of the models predict that sea level will rise in the next 50 years. That's not under debate. But there's a broad spread to these different predictions, and these are very, very important to get right if you're an island nation that's only 30 centimeters off the ocean. You'd like to know whether the sea level rise is going to differ by 30 centimeters or not. Likewise, San Diego and other low-lying areas like Miami. Now, this uncertainty is about 30 to 40 centimeters. And it turns out climate models have a number of degrees of uncertainty. And some of them include clouds and ice sheets. And it turns out that if you run different internal wave simulations with different patterns of turbulence by internal waves, like I just showed, so different climate models have different internal wave, then you get different answers for the sea level rise moving into the future. And so the take-home message here is that we really need to get internal waves right. We need to know where they're breaking in order to improve our climate simulations. Okay, so now returning to this movie, which shows the waves being generated at certain spots, which we now know fairly well, and then they propagate far away or radiate way away. The next question is, what happens to them? So a couple natural hypotheses are that they could just kind of slowly break little by little in the interior of the ocean, or likewise, they could actually then hit the boundaries of the ocean and break in kind of a more dramatic way. So our next move is actually another large experiment that's led here by Scripps, by Rob Pinkel. And a number of us here at Oregon State University, University of Washington, and University of Alaska, Fairbanks, are participating in this. This is an experiment where we've identified a very, very special hotspot in the ocean just south of the island of New Zealand. And you can see that there's more of these waves being radiated away from New Zealand. And what happens is that they rocket over towards Tasmania, and then the question is, what happens then? We expect them to partly reflect, and we expect them to partly break. And so we've designed a large array of moorings, which in fact we are so excited because our whole team finally closed the door on our two 40-foot containers full of 30 kilometers worth of line and, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds of anchors on its way to Tasmania today. And what our plan is to instrument this very, very large array of moorings to detect the passage of these waves and actually measure the turbulence and see them breaking. So this is where we see things going, is that we really need to do more experiments like T-Tide, which, by the way, if you want to find out more about it, there was a URL on the screen that just passed. Fine, I'll show it again. This is ttide.ucsd.edu, and again, acknowledging Amy Waterhouse for all of her work in setting up that website. We need to understand where internal waves break. We also need to know that there are more, there are parts of the globe that are more sensitive for climate change than others, and the poles are one of them. Now, I mentioned wind-generated internal waves a moment ago. Now, as the Arctic, for example, becomes more and more ice-free, there's more wind hitting working on the ocean, and so you might expect more and more waves, which are generating more and more mixing. That's a possible feedback loop that we're very interested in. And so Jen and I have an experiment next summer where we'll go to the Arctic and measure some of these processes. And then finally, we always need to continue to push on the technology and develop better equipment to allow better, more, and cheaper measurements so that we're not undersampling the ocean as badly as we have. So, okay, I'll just leave you with the take-home message here is that internal waves are huge in the ocean. They're as large as skyscrapers, hundreds and hundreds of meters or 1,000 feet. And they're big enough to matter for marine ecosystems, which Gino will be talking about just next. And they're really important because when they break, they mix. And getting the mixing right is very, very important for climate models. And that will segue into Richard's talk because this is the ocean response to climate change. And Richard's work is focusing on getting the forcing right, so the amount of CO2 that we'll be emitting in the future as well. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Matthew. I'm very excited to be here tonight and thrilled to be a part of this Founders Day celebration. So, and honored to be sharing the stage with the rest of these great UCSD researchers tonight. I've gotten a lot of questions about my title, and so I think I need to address acknowledge my wife, Lisa, who's also a UCSD alum, but she's not an engineer. She's a writer who happens to have a number of stories that have appeared in these Chicken Soup books. And when I told her my original title, which had something to do with wave boundary layers and turbulent dissipation and irregular roughness, she didn't think that was a good idea. So I came up with something a little bit more Chicken Soupy. Also looking at that title, you might ask yourself why an engineer would be talking to you about coral reefs. And to begin with, there's a lot we can learn from coral reefs in terms of fluid processes over irregular complex surfaces, which is a topic that has a lot of implications for engineering. In addition, I'm going to be talking about physical processes in the context of coral reefs, but these physical processes also play important roles in many other coastal dynamics problems that have implications for environmental engineering, coastal engineering like storm surge, erosion, water quality, etc. And then finally, I think there's a long history of close interaction between engineering here at UC San Diego and oceanography at Scripps in terms of trying to understand these physical processes. And that's personally what drew me here to work on my PhD research. When I was working in mechanical engineering, I was working with a physical oceanography professor, Larry Army, at Scripps. So I'm going to talk a little bit to start with about some of the pressures that coral reefs are facing. We're all aware of many of the stresses that are occurring as a result of changing climate. And I'm going to show you to start with this. This is the famous Keeling curve in red that shows the changes in CO2 in the atmosphere over the last 50 years. And so there's a significant increase. And it turns out that increase is also reflected in the ocean. The data in blue show observations from Station Aloha, which is located just north of Hawaii. And so there's an increase in carbon dioxide in the ocean as well. And then this increase, because of the carbonate chemistry in the ocean, results in an increase in acidity. And so that's reflected in a decrease in pH that you see there in green. So the oceans are getting more acidic. Now, you may know that coral reefs are made of calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate is also the main component in limestone, but it also turns out to be, as you may know, the main component in tums. And it plays pretty much the same role which a lot of people take for acid indigestion, and of course coral reefs play very much the same role in the ocean. Just like the tums dissolves in your stomach to counteract the acidity, the coral reefs dissolve to counteract increasing acidity in the ocean. So clearly that's not a good thing for corals. I give this as one example. There's many other things that are stressing ecosystems on the planet. I'm going to be talking about physical processes, and understanding these physical processes is essential if we want to be able to understand how these ecosystems, like coral reefs, will respond and so that we can predict and assess the risks that are associated with changing climate. So why should corals care about physics? Well, to begin with, we need to understand that corals occur in environments that are very low in nutrients, essentially oceanic deserts. And so the physics can resolve this in two ways. First, currents, which are associated with tides or waves, are essentially work as a pipeline to bring nutrients towards the coast from deep sources offshore. And we'll give that the symbol capital U. And then fluctuations, chaotic variations near the bed, which we'll call this symbol U star, we call those turbulence. And those are very useful in increasing the exchange. Those help coral to exchange nutrients between the water column and the bed, much in the same way that the sugar in your coffee or tea dissolves faster when you mix it with a spoon, right? So because corals can't move to get their food, they rely on the physics to bring it to them. And in the same way, they rely on physics to deal with waste removal, transport of larvae for reproduction, sedimentation. But of course, too much physics is also not a good thing. And if these forces are too great, these can lead to structural stress and breakage. So there's a happy point that corals want to be at in terms of physics. I think this video illustrates very well these two processes that I've been describing. This is an this is a video actually of laboratory experiments carried out by colleagues at Stanford University, showing experiments of flow over coral. And what they've done is they have fluorescent dye injected in the coral and a laser sheet to visualize this. And I think this, again, shows these two processes very well. This capital U, the currents, are associated with the back and forth motion that's carrying the dye on a large scale. And then the turbulence are these very small fluctuations near the bed that are carrying dye, in this case, away from the bed, much in the same way that they would carry wastes away, and also nutrients to the bed. Now, Matthew offered just talked to you a lot about internal waves and how internal waves travel across the ocean much in the same way that surface waves travel across. And in the same way that these waves, that surface waves approach a shoreline, internal waves also approach coasts, break. And it turns out that that process, the processes associated with internal waves, are very important for corals. And so to understand those physical processes, we went to the Kilauea Observatory on the south shore of Oahu to carry out some work with colleagues from Stanford and Oregon State. Kilauea is an observatory. It's essentially an in-ocean laboratory that I established and ran for about 8 years until 2012. And it has experimental sites at about 30 feet and about 70 feet depth. And each one of these sites provides what amounts to an extension cord. It provides Ethernet ports and power so that you can run customized experiments. And so as part of this experiment, we built a 26-foot tower that we deployed at 75 feet depth, which you see in the images here. On the left is my master's student, Lauren Molina, and on the right is a Stanford PhD student, Mike Squibb, adjusting some of the instrumentation. And the instrumentation on the tower is very similar to some of the things that Matthew uses in the deep ocean. We use acoustics to measure velocity. We measure turbulence and changes in temperature to try to get an idea of what the processes are associated with these shoaling, these internal waves that are washing up on the reefs. And this is what internal waves look like when they wash up on the reefs. So the top plot, so what we're looking at here is images of density, but the density is primarily driven by temperature, so you can consider this as though it were temperature. The top plot shows about 8 days and versus depth on the vertical axis, about 8 days of data, and you can see that mostly the water over the reef is warm, indicated by the red regions, but with intermittent pulses of this sharp blue, which is associated with these internal waves. So these waves are washing up on the slope, on the reefs, in much the same way that surface waves wash up on the beach and knock over your sandcastle. On the bottom, if we zoom in on this, we're looking at about 10 hours of data here. And you can see, again, this primarily warm water with very sharp change as this wave washes up and extends over most of the depth, at least most of the height of the tower. And that cold water then remains on the reef for about 3 hours before it washes back off. Okay. Now, this cold water, these internal waves, do a lot more than just cool off the reef, which is in itself an important process. So what I'm showing here is a plot that shows the typical variation in nutrients, which the reefs need, which is essentially your chicken soup, and as a function of depth. And so as I was describing earlier, there's very little nutrient content at the surface in red, and blue shows temperature. So these cold pulses that are associated with the internal waves bring nutrients up to the reef from down deep. So that's an important process. And so these internal waves then play two roles in the reefs. One of them is they provide this capital U, this pipeline that provides a supply of of nutrients. And then they also, it turns out, they also increase this U-star, this turbulence near the bed that helps increase the transport. Our work has shown us that the cross-shore flow associated with these internal waves increases by a factor of 5 relative to when there are no internal waves. And other work by people at Scripps, including Jim Leichter, have shown that for reefs in Florida, this amounts to about 100-fold increase in nutrients because this water that's coming up is so rich in nutrients. Okay, so I've told you a little bit about this capital U, and really a lot of the focus in my work and my group's work is in trying to quantify and predict this U-star. What is the level of this turbulence associated with the flow over the reef? And there's 3 parts to this problem. The first part is determining the currents, say, associated with tides or waves or internal waves, like I just showed you. The second part is actually defining the reef geometry. What does the reef look like? And how do we assign a number to that reef so that we can describe its roughness? And then the third part is resolving and predicting this turbulence, this U-star, based on measurements. Okay, so I've showed you a little bit about how we've looked at internal waves for determining this capital U. There's other mechanisms as well. And I'm going to describe a little bit about what we do to define the reef geometry. One of the key tools we use is an autonomous underwater vehicle, or an AUV. And this is basically an underwater robot that we program and send out over the reef to map and try to get a picture of what this reef bed looks like. It uses acoustics and video, like you see here on the right, to give us a picture of what the reef looks like. And it gives us maps that look like this. In this case, it's about 1 kilometer squared around the Kilauea Observatory in Hawaii. And what we're seeing are the variations in roughness at different sizes for this region. And what we've learned from this is that the roughness can be described by what we call a spectral distribution. That means that there's roughness at many different sizes, all the way from very small sizes to very large corals. Now, this poses a problem from the engineering perspective, because the typical engineering approach is to identify what the characteristic size is for a boundary, and then use that size to predict what this U-star turbulence is. However, what we see is that a coral reef doesn't have a characteristic size, so we have a problem. And so a lot of our work then has been directed towards making measurements of this U-star so that we can connect it to these observations of reef variations. And so we've made field observations at many places around the Pacific, a number of field sites that you see pictures of here. And then more recently, we've been carrying out laboratory experiments and computer simulations as well of flow over idealized boundaries, where the boundary, like you see here in this image, has a range of different sizes. Now, this no longer looks like a coral reef, of course, but it turns out that this boundary has been designed, this bottom has been designed, so that it has similar characteristics to what you see, what we've measured for a coral reef. And these are laser-induced fluorescence measurements made by my postdoc here, Payam Agsai. And what you see here again is this large capital U, and then you see the turbulence near the bed. And what these observations have shown us, what these experiments and numerical simulations have shown us, is that it's not the amplitude of the roughness that's important for these complex boundaries. Instead, we can now define an average cavity shape based on the variations that you see near the bed, and it's that quantity that actually determines what the characteristics of this U-star are. Okay, so hopefully I've managed to tell you, convey a little bit about what how physical processes are important for coral reefs. We've seen how internal waves, for example, are important in determining this capital U. I've shown you how this U-star is important in facilitating the local supply for reef organisms. And again, as I noted earlier, these processes that I'm describing are not unique to reefs. They're really important for many coastal problems. Again, you know, these ecosystems are under stress from changes in climate, and understanding these physical processes is critical for us to be able to assess the risks that are associated with climate change. Okay, thank you.
Let's see, as the economist in the group, I'm always the one with bad news. How much carbon dioxide do Matthew and Gino have to deal with in their models? And what you can see is that most of the attention in the last several years has turned to China. And UCSD has a tremendously good group of people working on all aspects of China. And we'll see this as we go along. But first, I should say, since this is a Founders Day symposium, it was Roger Revelle who got me interested in forecasting greenhouse gas emissions. And forecasting has long been sort of a strong suit of the economics department. The science literature has concentrated on this identity and variations of it, which says impact, think carbon dioxide, is equal to population, times affluence, think income, times technology, where usually the notion was to improve things, we would have to reduce population, keep income down, which was never popular, and do something on the technology side. Well, economists have looked at this relationship hundreds and hundreds of times across large numbers of countries, and we never see anything like the IPAD equation. What we see is this inverted U-shaped structure that what happens when countries are really poor, what, they have a rural agrarian economy, so they're not producing lots of pollution. But as they get richer, pollution levels go up. But at some point, the countries start using that extra income to deal with the pollution. So if we were to look at it currently, who's sort of way over here on the right? Norway. Norway has almost no pollution anymore. Everything's driven by renewables and hydro. The most popular car now in Norway is a Tesla. And I'm just going to give you an illustration of how similar two major coastal cities look like with the same income. This is Los Angeles, a la about 1975. This is a bad day, of course. But does this sort of... But you never see days like this in Los Angeles anymore. This is Shanghai. In 2013, it actually looks still the same now. But this is what happens. If you look at China now, where a lot of the focus is, the current estimates are China's killing over 1 million people a year with air pollution. It's a frightening sort of figure. There are all sorts of other reasons why this sort of IPAD formulation doesn't really work, and that is population's a very complex interaction with income. When income first goes up, what happens? Infant mortality goes down, so you get population spikes. Then, as income goes up, you want it to invest in human capital. In particular, for women, as you invest in human capital, birth rates eventually go down, and countries implement social security-type programs so you don't have the same dependence on your kids or needing to have large numbers of them survive. The technology adoption follows a very different flavor than usually thought, and what you can see is it's mainly driven by energy cost. What happens? When energy costs get really high, the government invests lots in R&D, private firms invest lots in R&D, and firms adopt lots of new technology to try to deal with this. And so Steffi Fried in the economics department, who's a PhD student, shows that you get a huge dynamic boost from what we call induced technological change by the energy costs. And so we try to do something really strange. We try to hold down energy costs and think about R&D investing, and so when energy is low, nobody has any interest. Then the quality of the regulatory institutions makes a large difference. And there are a group of people in political science and IRPS who work on this issue a lot. Foreign trade decouples consumption and production. So what have we done in the U.S.? We've offloaded all the dirty production to China and other developing countries. And then the cumulative CO2 emissions are influenced by the business cycle in two different ways. What happens? Countries grow at very different rates, and the path that they take to get someplace can vary a lot. So here's some notion of what would happen with fairly simple projections of what CO2 emissions were going to be at four key dates. 1983, the first time the U.S. thought about regulating CO2 emissions. 1992, when we agreed to do something as a set of nations in Rio, which you can see that was the time which the thought was that U.S. emissions were the real problem. Then 1997, when a number of countries signed the Kyoto Protocol. And then you can look more recently at 2007, which was right before the Copenhagen meeting. And what can you see? You can see that the U.S. emissions have dropped precipitously. The Europeans, who talk a really good game, are not really even in it anymore. And the Chinese emissions have just gone up by an enormous amount. So one of the things I do and get in lots of trouble doing is forecast Chinese CO2 emissions. So with a graduate student of mine, Max Offheimer, who's a professor now at UC Berkeley, we forecasted that China's CO2 emissions would pass the U.S. in 2006. Well, this was 15 years before the official estimates which were driving the climate negotiations. And it had large political implications. I do lots of things where it takes 10 or 15 years for anything to happen. In this case, I sent out copies of the paper to people in the U.S. government and the British government and got a call from the British government. They said, why don't you come to London and give us a briefing? And Tony Blair, 3 days later, gave a speech with the tagline from the paper which said the annual increase in Chinese CO2 emissions were more than the entire emissions of the United Kingdom. Anyway, the climate sort of negotiations started to unravel at about that point. And we've continued to sort of look at how well our model's done. So what you can see back here is around 2000, things radically changed. That was when the Chinese government and the U.S. government sat down and made it both clear to each other that they weren't going to join the Kyoto Protocol. And at that point, the Chinese technology changed radically. And so we tried to measure this in lots of ways. And so we didn't really have enough data. And so we went and we started modeling each of the Chinese provinces, the 30 provinces. And the other thing we could see is that the technology that they were locking in locked them into a really bad long-run trajectory. So, and that's what we see now. So anyway, in 2012, our model was 1.2% off. And you could sort of see the purple line, the dark purple line, was the official projection at the time. Anyway, everybody's now picked up the way we were modeling things, so that was good. And you can look at the major source of uncertainty now in China is no longer really income. But if you looked at that inverted U-shape, what's it saying? It's saying that actually countries like cities like Beijing and Shanghai are near the top. And what's going to happen there is that population growth in China coupled with the technology they put in over the next decade are going to be the main driving forces, not income, in China. So we've tried to come up with so economists usually are credited with not being optimistic, but we've been doing lots of work on what happens if you were to put a price on carbon in China? And by a price, we mean a carbon tax, which economists love carbon taxes. That translates into gas taxes and electricity taxes. You can also have cap and trade programs. So that's another way to put a price on carbon. The leaders of the developing countries, China and India in particular, have argued that reducing their CO2 emissions is going to really hinder their development. So what they're doing is they're trading off environmental quality, better environmental quality. And if we were to look at the cities in China, that's the thing that the mayors are really pushing. They know their people really would like to get the air pollution levels down, and they're willing to trade off some of that income. But there are lots of political implications of slowing the growth rate down. And anyway, the expressed opinions of the Chinese and Indian leaders are very consistent with the economic studies of the U.S., which say that you're going to take somewhat of a hit in terms of economic growth if you put on carbon taxes. In a paper that we've just given in China and Washington in the past couple months, Mark Jacobson, who's an associate professor in the economics department, and Anthony Liu, who's a former graduate student here, who's at Resources for the Future in Washington, what we've done is we've shown that if you put on a carbon tax in China big enough to get a 10% reduction in CO2 emissions, that China's economy would grow 1% quicker. Now, I think if you were to tell any U.S. leader you could figure out how to get 1% more economic growth, you know, they would do hand flips and say really strange things about you. but anyway, how do you do this? It turns out there's something very different about developing countries. They have lots of tax evasion. Well, it turns out that environmental carbon sort of taxes are really hard to evade. What do? You have a small number of petroleum refineries that you level the tax on. You have a relatively small number of electric power plants you levy the tax on, so it's very hard to evade. And so that overcomes one of the problems in the U.S. is that you really want to make a tax efficient, you want it to be broad-based. And so that's the problem in the U.S., but you actually make the tax broader in developing countries because of the way it goes on. The other thing you do is it causes the informal sector, which is much bigger in developing countries than in the U.S., to grow quicker. Because what happens? You take the tax revenue and you reduce labor taxes and capital taxes, and that moves activity from the informal sector to the formal sector, which is growing quicker. And the last thing you need is you have to have the sort of bad fossil fuel departments, deposits, in this case coal, in the ground, and they can't get off and walk away. So the problem with taxing lots of businesses, if they don't like what you're doing, they just move across the border. But your coal that's in the ground can't move, so you can actually tax it. And that's sort of the hopeful note, that what happens is that these carbon taxes, which everybody in the developing countries feared would cause them not to be able to grow as quick as they want, if done in the right way, and it has large implications too, because there are going to be lots of gainers and losers. So this is not no cakewalk in that sense. But anyway, if you do this in the right way, the developing countries can actually get on board in terms of climate change and do so in a way that causes their growth to actually go up. And the key thing, we've got 10% in here, but to keep doing this, you have to keep fueling R&D into technology. So once you set this process in motion, you can keep cutting the carbon emissions at the rate at which you can do technological progress. Okay, and that's it.
All very interesting, isn't it? Thank you, Matthew, Gino, and Richard. Our next group of speakers will focus on health, enriching human life and society. Human health is impacted by our environment, the bacteria that co-inhabit our bodies, the proteins that our cells produce, our metabolism, and our genomes. Here at UC San Diego, advances in discipline-specific knowledge and novel technological capabilities provide new opportunities for multidisciplinary and translational work with the potential to keep people healthy and transform the delivery of healthcare. Making good on that potential will require the processing of huge amounts of data, for which the campus is well-positioned. Key organizing frameworks that support our work in this area include the Institute for Engineering and Medicine, for example, promotes collaborations between faculty in the health sciences and engineering to develop creative new technologies to improve health and clinical care. The Qualcomm Institute provides a meeting ground for engineering, information, and communication technologies, the digital arts, and applications to societal problem solving, and for mapping human and microbial genomics, and for defining the human health and basic biology in terms of integrated omics, genomics, metabolomics, proteomics, etc. The San Diego Supercomputer Center exemplifies the tradition of developing the technological infrastructure and data analytics software to enable massive data sets to be applied to complex phenomena. UC San Diego is also a leader in the understanding, prevention, and treatment of many diseases, including cardiovascular, neurological diseases, and cancer. Our next group of speakers will describe some of the ways in which UC San Diego is leading the path to better health through utilization of big data across disciplines. Dr. Rizal Kurzak from the Moores Cancer Center will demonstrate the potential promises and challenges of personalized cancer medicine. Dr. Lucila Ono Machado from the Division of Biomedical Informatics will discuss UC San Diego's place at the forefront of the learning healthcare system revolution, finding patterns in healthcare and genomic data by using supercomputers and multidisciplinary teams of experts in medicine, informatics, computer science, statistics, and engineering. And Dr. Bill Griswold from the Department of Computer Science and Engineering will discuss the potential health impact of the proliferation of smartphones and the advent of compact sensors to enable real-time monitoring of air quality. So let me introduce our group of speakers. Rizal Kurzak received her medical degree from the University of Toronto. She is best known for successfully creating and chairing the largest Phase 1 clinical trials department in the world while at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Her unique approach emphasized a personalized strategy to optimize cancer treatment by using cutting-edge molecular profiling technologies to match patients with novel targeted therapies. Dr. Kurzak has served as a principal investigator on more than 90 clinical trials and has overseen more than 300 trials, mainly using novel targeted molecules, several of which have gone on to Food and Drug Administration approval. Tonight, she'll share how genomics and immunotherapy are increasing survival in a remarkable way and seeing responses in patients who were previously considered untreatable. William Griswold received his doctorate in computer science from the University of Washington. His research interests include software engineering and ubiquitous computing, specializing in the construction of large, complex software systems, software design, aspect-oriented software development, mobile applications, and educational technology. Griswold is a pioneer in the area of software refactoring. He built Active Campus, one of the early mobile location-aware systems, and his CitySense project has been investigating technologies for low-cost, universal, real-time air quality sensing. Tonight, he'll discuss how pervasive data collection and analysis can reveal the state of our world and how it affects our well-being on a daily basis. Lucila Ono Machado received her medical degree from the University of Sao Paulo and her doctoral degree in medical information sciences and computer science from Stanford University. Her research interests include biomedical informatics, predictive modeling, and biomedical data analytics. She is currently the lead investigator on the Biomedical and Healthcare Data Discovery and Indexing Ecosystems Project, a three-year National Institutes of Health-funded project to help modernize and transform how researchers share, use, find, and cite biomedical data sets. Tonight, she'll share why data sharing is important in the context of being able to answer real questions from real people, e.g., what would be the best therapy for me? And she'll share the challenges of this important work at the intersection of humanities, science, and engineering. Please welcome Dr. Rizal Kurzak.
Well, thank you very much for having me speak here, and really an incredible group of speakers. I guess I'll walk around like other people did before me, and so it's a hard act to follow. But I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what's happening in the cancer field. And I think just about everybody gets touched by cancer sooner or later. One in every three people. people develop, are diagnosed with cancer, and there's really hardly anybody that hasn't had somebody in their family diagnosed, or they themselves have been diagnosed with cancer. And unfortunately, especially when cancer becomes metastatic, it really becomes difficult to treat, and most patients do die of it. But I think we're really beginning to understand cancer much better, and hopefully we'll be able to change that in the near future. So what I'm going to talk to you about is this idea of personalizing therapy and actually matching patients with target-based agents. So what are target-based agents? These are drugs that have been developed to target specific abnormalities that drive cancer cells, but are not found in normal cells or expressed at a much lower level in normal cells. And that means that while these agents can kill the cancer cells, they don't do a lot of damage to the normal cells. So there's a much bigger differential than with classic chemotherapy. Now, one thing I hear very frequently is that we need new drugs to treat cancer. And of course, that's a really great idea. We always need new drugs to treat cancer. But there's actually a very fundamental problem in the way we classify cancer. And unless we overcome that problem, it really doesn't matter how many new drugs we develop. So I'm going to give you a really simple example. But I hope it'll illustrate the thinking. So I think everybody here would understand that insulin is a really great drug, a revolutionary drug, but it wouldn't be a revolutionary drug if we used it to treat pneumonia. Actually, it would be a pretty lousy drug. And we would conclude, if we used insulin to treat pneumonia, not only that insulin is not a very good drug, but that pneumonia is a really difficult disease to treat. And I know that sounds simplistic, but essentially that's probably what we've done in cancer for most of my career. We may have really good drugs, but we have no idea to which patients to give them. And so we sort of give them randomly to patients, and a few respond here and there, but that doesn't work out very well. But I think we have a lot more knowledge now, and we have the tools to really change that. And that's really what I want to talk about. Just a little bit of background about myself and how I came to think about this. I worked at MD Anderson for a long period of time, and I was charged with building a new department, which was a department of phase one clinical trials, which are those drugs that have moved for the first time from animals to humans. And there's been now a wealth of drugs that are targeted against specific signals known to be abnormal in cancer that have now moved into the clinic, into patients. And what we started doing around the end of 2007 is applying some of the new genomic molecular profiling techniques to understand the genomic abnormalities in patients and to match them with drugs. Now, as you might imagine, technology available, the tools available in the end of 2007 when we started doing this was pretty primitive compared to what we have available today. But nevertheless, by doing a few thousand patients, we learned a lot. And I'll tell you a little bit about what we learned. And I think one of the main take-home messages that I would like to impart is that the future is here. A lot of what I want to talk about transforming cancer treatment is not something that will happen in 5 or 10 years from now, but it's actually something that we're doing right now. And that doesn't mean that we still don't have more to learn. Of course we do. But it's not all about the future anymore. It's about the now. So why are cancers so difficult to treat? Why has it been really so tough? This is a pie chart about lung cancer. We used to think lung cancer was one disease. But what we now know is that actually lung cancer is made up of multiple different diseases, and each subset is defined by a different genomic abnormality. And therefore, what we used to think is, can we find this? Why do we keep on finding drugs that work in 5% of lung cancer? You know, we really need a better drug that's going to work in 90%. But now we understand that that may be biologically impossible, because in fact, The reason a drug works in 5% is because that 5% defines a subgroup of patients that are that in which the lung cancer is caused by a specific abnormality. So the idea more and more is now to divide and conquer. We have to divide the diseases up based on their molecular abnormalities in order to contact them. And we have to understand that each patient is different and that specific targeted agents will work only when given to the right patient who has the sensitizing abnormality. So we had created a protocol that I want to talk to you about, and I think it'll illustrate a little bit about where this is going. It was called PREDICT, or Profile-Related Evidence Determining Individualized Cancer Therapy. And we began to look at cancer in what we called histology-independent approach. So histology-independent means we weren't looking at it in the classic way. Usually you diagnose cancer as if it comes from the breast, it's a breast cancer. If it comes from the colon, it's a colon cancer. We didn't really worry about where it came from. We wanted to know the underlying molecular abnormality that was driving the cancer, regardless of where it came from, and then to match patients with the appropriate drugs. The patients that came to us in this setting, I want to mention, they were end-stage cancer patients. By definition, because they were going on early experimental therapy, each patient had already been told that there was nothing more that could be done for them, and they had failed to respond to usually about 4 or 5 different therapies in the metastatic setting. So these are really pretty tough patients. And we began to look at the mutations, and I use PIK3CA as an example. It's a common mutation, and it drives cancers. But there's a few points I want to make from this slide. First of all, it was found in about 10% of 1,000 patients with advanced cancer. But I think what you can see is it was found in a subset of multiple different cancers. And this, endometrial cancer, 29%, breast cancer is 24%. And really, if you look at almost any cancer, you can find this abnormality. And more importantly, the aberration didn't segregate by organ of origin. So this means that our classic way of classifying cancers wasn't really working out, because if we're going to give a drug that suppresses the PIK3CA, we can't choose patients by whether they have breast or colon cancer. We have to choose them by whether or not they have the abnormality. And so this is what happened when we started treating patients in this way. Remember, these are end-stage patients. This is a waterfall plot and shows if the patient is progressing or not. Anything below the horizontal line is a response. Anything above is progression. And this is what happens when you do this the normal way, where you diagnose cancer, whether they're breast or colon, but without molecular matching. You get about 5% of patients responding. So it's not very high. But when we started treating patients by matching them at a molecular level, the response rates went up to 27%. Certainly not what we'd like it to be, but about 5 times higher than the baseline response rates. And more importantly, we really began to see some very interesting things, which suggested that genomics was a disruptive technology and that we really have to begin to think differently about the way we do clinical trials and the way we do practice. So this is a series of patients on which we do genomic testing, and we actually did 75. These are breast cancer patients. And these are the genomic abnormalities that you see in these patients. But the main thing that I want to point out is that there's no two that are the same. Some patients have things in common, but even when they have something in common, the rest of their genomic portfolio is different. And yet, the way we treat patients and the way we do clinical research is to try and find things in common between patients and treat them in the same way. But this tells us that that's not going to work because each patient is different. And actually, we expect it's going to get even more complicated because we've only been doing genomics, and yet there's so much more to do. There's the RNA, there's protein, there's so much more. We're just touching the tip of the iceberg. So this individuality is going to become even more pronounced. So a little bit about what we're doing at Moores Cancer Center to make this real for patients. We've developed a center for personalized cancer therapy. It has multiple different components. And it tries to take advantage of some of the real strengths in the area, the 600 biotech startups, the supercomputer center, the collaborations with all the great science, Salk, Sanford Burnham, Scripps, UCSD, and developing new clinical trials. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about we've developed a molecular tumor board. So this really makes it real for patients. So we have now sequenced about 1,000 patients with clinical grade sequencing. This is sequencing that can actually be used to make decisions on patients. And we bring together our physicians, our radiologists, our surgeons, but also our bioinformatics specialists, people from the supercomputer center, our scientists, and we try to make decisions on these patients, usually they're end-stage patients, where we use the molecular profiling to specifically make a decision of targeted and tailored treatment recommendations for these patients. I've talked about the tumor, but we're really discovering that hereditary predispositions are also going to be very important. And again, I think we've just begun to touch the tip of the iceberg here. So what the patient's genomics, not just the tumor genomics, may tell us their immunity, their immune response. Will they have side effects from the drug and so forth? And, you know, so the question is, does this robust, this is real actually, 100-year-old woman, was this really good luck that she smokes like a chimney and is in really good health? Or was this genomically predetermined? And I really believe it's genomically predetermined. And in the same way, we may be able to determine if people will have side effects from a drug or if they'll have an immune response as well. And then, you know, I'd like to finish off by saying that this is really not just about cancer. I believe that cancer is the forefront because it's been such a horrible disease and such an urgent problem. But I want to give you this example. This is really going to touch all of medicine. So you see this woman, and she has bladder cancer, and her bladder cancer is due to a mutation in a gene called FGFR3 that developed in her bladder. And we have drugs now that can specifically impact and inhibit that gene function. But what is really fascinating to me is what you see on the other side is people with achondroplastic dwarfism. And they have the exact same mutation, but they were born with it. And so is it possible that the drugs that we're now using in cancer could affect some of these children? This is not an isolated incident. This is really, we are finding out in cancer all sorts of things that are meaningful outside the cancer field. Thank you very much for listening. San Diego's incredibly beautiful.
So what we just saw in the previous talk is amazing. And what I'd like to think about is taking that to the next step, which is preventing disease, or at least being able to predict it with personalized medicine approach. This is what the CitiSense project is about. And to get to that point, we have to be able to measure the environment, because that's where so many of our ailments and our illnesses come from. And in particular, in the CitiSense project, we've been measuring air quality. So let me walk you through that and explain why we've chosen that as a target. So 89% is the amount that air quality in San Diego County has been reduced since 1989. It's an amazing, amazing accomplishment. But still, we have a long way to go. Half is the number of proportion of U.S. citizens who live in counties that have an air quality violation according to federal air standards in the last year. That's a lot of people. 29 is the incremental number of cancers caused in Chula Vista, California, due to pollutants due to trucks and autos. 50% is the increase in asthma events when you are near highways, 50%. And tragically, 30% of all public schools are near those highways. So we have to think twice about sending our kids to school, it seems like. And lastly, 4 million is the number of children in the U.S. who experience some type of asthma event every year, at least one. Obviously, millions also experience more than one asthma event. So we have a long way to go in spite of these great accomplishments. And in fact, as more of this literature comes out on air pollution, we're discovering that how sensitive we are to air pollution and how much it affects our health. And that's why I took on the CitiSense project. So the question, of course, from the personalized perspective is, how is this air pollution affecting you? We actually have very little idea. Why? Well, we live in a county of 4,000 square miles. It's huge. 3 million residents, most of us around here and to the south. But we only have 10 EPA-mandated air quality monitoring stations monitoring our air quality. Why only 10? Well, part of it is that they're monitoring the regional air quality and they're not trying to assess our exposure. But another part of the answer is this. The stations that they use are enormous. They take tremendous amounts of power. They need to be secured. They're very precise. But you can't drop one of these in your neighborhood. So unfortunately, these stations aren't near where you live, where you work, or on your commute. So this led me to the idea of taking a computing approach to measuring air pollution and our exposures. So let me give you a scenario. Here we have Sarah in downtown La Jolla shopping, and she's thinking about going on a run later today, maybe down in Mission Bay. Well, she's concerned about her air quality because she's asthmatic. And so what can she do? Well, she could hop on the internet, go to the EPA website, and what would she discover? The prediction is moderate air quality. Well, we know that's not quite right. That's from those 10 stations I talked about. So what could we do? Well, let's take that computing approach. Let's manufacture a little computing board, drop some sensors on it, put a little Bluetooth module on that, and then can talk to her phone and show her instantaneous readings of the pollution she's being exposed to. Well, that's great, but unfortunately, she's planning on running later down in Mission Bay, so these readings aren't very useful to her yet. But of course, there are lots of people like Sarah, and so we could have several of these devices deployed around, some even down by Mission Bay. Well, that's good, but I still need the air pollution later. So what we could do is collect all that information from all of those users, all of those people measuring their personal air quality, submit that to the internet, to a server, apply machine learning algorithms on those, or what we used to call artificial intelligence, throw in that EPA data for good measure, and then we can provide a detailed map. Not a map just for now, but it's predictive because we have historical data over time, and so we can even predict your exposure in the future. So that's the CitiSense concept. Now, once we have that, we can make that available to everyone, anyone with a smartphone or a computer. And of course, we can also share that information with public health, news outlets, and your doctor. So now we have a totally new way, a computational approach, to measuring air pollution and your exposure to it. Now, before I go on, I don't want to leave you the idea that this idea came out of thin air. I was inspired by David Brin's book, The Transparent Society, the way Wikipedia is managed by or is populated by people just like us writing articles, and so on and so forth. And that's what gave me the idea for CitiSense. Now, CitiSense was not easy to achieve. There are many challenges required, many challenges had to be overcome in order to be successful. So my colleague Sanjoy Dasgupta took the lead on the machine learning aspects of this project to compute that high-resolution map that I talked about earlier. Mobile power is a big problem. You have to keep these devices on all the time, both the phone and the board. And Tiana Rosing led that effort. Of course, the software needs to be able to adapt to the power requirements and the pollution in the environment. And so Professor Ingolf Kruger took on the adaptive software components. My colleague Kevin Patrick in the School of Medicine took on the efficacy component. And me personally, I worked on how everyday people would use and respond to having a device like this in their hands. So a little bit more detail on the components of CitiSense. We have here the board. That's life size right there, about 3.5 feet across. So a small handheld board. It's got three air quality sensors on it. There are only two there right in that picture. Carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, and ozone, typical pollutants from trucks and autos, which are the primary source of pollutants in San Diego. And then there's a Bluetooth module on there that lets it communicate to your phone and provide displays like this. Oh, I should go back and say this board was designed by Piero Zappi, a postdoc at the time. He now works at Qualcomm here in town. So now we have this this app. That effort was led by Neiman Nixod, including a lot of the power management work. It provides a color display and a numeric display based on the EPA's AQI pollution reporting system. Now, if you press that little Facebook button, you can actually post a short history of your data as a map to Facebook, so you can share that with your friends and try to raise their awareness. The phone also acts as a backhaul to our back-end servers, where, first of all, you get a lot more personal information, such as these pollution trails, that's sort of a replay of your day. This was developed by Chalal Zifshi, who now works at Google. And then I told you earlier about these pollution maps that Sanjoy Dasgupta led, and this work was actually carried out by Nukul Verma, graduate student, who's now working at a research institute on the East Coast. So having built this system, we're in a position to do that study that I want to do, which is, when you have this in your hands, people just like us, you know, what happens? And so we contacted commuters at UCSD and invited them onto our study. This is a month-long study conducted with about 24 people. And the study itself was carried out by Nicole Quick from the School of Medicine. She's now a physician in Utah. And my student, Liz Bales, who's now up in Seattle working for Google. And the questions they asked what would these commuters encounter? I mean, what actual pollution were they being exposed to? And having been exposed to that, how would that change their attitudes and awareness? And finally, would it affect their behavior? Would they be able to do anything about it, given that they're not going to be able to change the pollution? You know, what could they do? So here's an example of one person's commute home one afternoon. Let me walk you through this. So this is a cyclist. So UCSD is over here. And this is just reporting carbon monoxide on this route. So over here, the carbon monoxide levels are very low. But when they cross the congested highway, that red line there from Google Maps says there's stop and go traffic, the carbon monoxide levels, you know, leap off the charts. Things get much better as you cross over. They got a little bit worse again when they got over near the 805, and then things were fine for the rest of their trip home. And so what we see here is that pollution is highly variant by locale, unlike what's reported by the EPA monitoring stations. Simply looking at this data over time, not necessarily space like we looked at there, we see a very similar pattern. So here on the bottom of the chart, we see the EPA reported average air quality, sort of good for the entire day with a couple of dips. And here we see six individual users' exposures throughout the day. And we see through most of the day that their exposure is actually below the average. That's because they're indoors away from air pollution. But on their commute to work, breaks for lunch, and then their commutes home, you have huge jumps in exposure. And these sorts of things matter because, say, with things like asthma, those triggers come from those peak exposures. Okay? So that's pretty interesting. So these users, having had these systems in their hand for a month, were a fount of information when we interviewed them. And I won't be able to tell you everything that they said, but I'll just give you a little taste. So we learned things about awareness. One subject reported, "It never occurred to me how bad the air is as cars drive by while I'm waiting for the bus." And I'll just, as an aside here, this was a common comment. It turns out that the people who are doing the most for reducing my air pollution by commuting on a bus are sitting at a polluted bus stop and getting additional exposures. It seems a little unfair. We also learned things about attitudes. One subject reported, "It's made me aware that polluting our air is like fish pooping in their tank." And we also learned things about behavior. And this was the big surprise for us. We thought that our users would feel helpless because this is where I live, this is where I work, this is the air pollution, I'm done. But in fact, people did change their behavior. So as one subject said, "I'm more conscious of leaving my car idling and keeping the windows closed on the freeway." And it was a surprise, but closing your windows in your car actually does reduce your exposure, or at least your peak exposures. And so that's what a lot of people learned to do. But they did other things. Bicyclists and walkers changed the routes that they walked because some roads are much more polluted than others. Some changed the air filters at work. Others took their soldering irons outdoors so they wouldn't get more ventilation. And another closed the windows on the highway side of their apartment. So this is one of several of the things that they did. So the first phase of the Citizens Project is over, but it's continuing in a new form. So one of the problems is when you deploy a system like this to dozens of people, how do you keep it up and running? Turns out these sensors go out of calibration pretty quickly, 3 to 6 months, and they go out of calibration very suddenly. So now we're looking at using crowd-enabled techniques, just like we're using for building those maps, to detect that sensors are out of calibration and ultimately be able to recalibrate them without taking them out of service. And secondly, in a project with Kevin Patrick, and Yannis Papakonstantinou, we're working on what I call personalized population health, which is being able to collect medical record and personal health data, slice it and dice it, so to pull out data that's like your data, and then we can make predictions about what your health is going to be in the future by looking at people who are just like you. Well, that's my talk. I just have a couple of parting thoughts. So first is that this crowd-enabled sensing idea is a computing approach to an old problem. And I think a lot of problems that we face today we can have new insights on those problems by taking a computing approach. And Citizens is one example of that. And the other is that this project, as all of the things we've heard about here today, is an example of the deep and practical research that's possible in the university when we're given the time and the resources to take on these hard problems.
Oh, thank you. As the last and least, I must say, if you're not amazed by now, you're tough. And what I wanted to go through today is some thoughts about, we are collecting all this data, what does it mean to you? And I must say it will apply to every one of you. So I just want to take a survey here. Who in the past 2 years has visited a doctor's office or has been a doctor in the past 2 years? All right, some are negligent with their health. I'm not going to comment on that. But the majority of people here have a clinic experience and so on. And why do we care about big data and about this learning healthcare system, this data that are being collected in the clinic while you're being seen for well care or for a particular disease? So how do we enrich human life and society by collecting data in a responsible manner, sharing it, and learning from it? So that's the thoughts that I want you to get out of this presentation with. So 2 years ago, the Office of Science and Technology Policy of the White House invited a couple of us to help them pass the message that big data is a big deal. It's a big deal in education, and a colleague from Stanford presented about that, on economics, in healthcare, which I had the privilege of being there representing our sector, in physical sciences. And we talked about how big data would change the way we're doing business today in our respective fields. So biomedical informatics, what is it? Well, it deals with big data a lot. Electronic health records are out there. They have wide adoption in the U.S. They're going to be 100% in a couple years. So we are collecting that data. What are we doing with it? We are also collecting data from clinical studies, for mobile health devices, as you just heard, from social media. And what is the usage? We just heard today, targeted therapy is one of them. Targeted prevention is another one of them. Disease surveillance and patient safety. And that last one you might have not heard about, but I will talk a little bit about how it's important and how our healthcare system is particularly involved in those efforts. So the thing that makes us unique makes us very difficult to treat disease, to prevent disease. We just heard about that. So how can we use that kind of data plus the data that we were traditionally very used to in medicine? So physical exam, tests in laboratory are very familiar to us. But now that comes genome, transcriptome, proteome, how can we integrate all of that and environmental data in order to treat and prevent disease? So patient safety, I said I would say a few words about that, and outcomes research. These are the kind of things that you can use the electronic health record to make better. So, for example, I have just here a screenshot of the Food and Drug Administration website. And as you know, drugs are recalled once in a while. Devices are recalled once in a while because they're not safe. They were deemed safe when they were tested on clinical trials, very well controlled with people with few diseases, few other conditions. When they go out in at large, people have more than one disease. People are taking other medications. There are a whole lot of things happening that weren't tested in the clinical trial phase. And by having that information in electronic health records, we can get to that information. So also outcomes for different procedures and therapies, as we heard today, that it's not one size fits all anymore. You are not one disease. You are you who happen to be labeled with that disease. So we need to understand that better. And preventive measures have been to be tailored accordingly. So why large data and what big data is important? Because large numbers help us detect these unsafe devices, medications, procedures much earlier. And this is a slide from my previous institution in Boston, in which we show that in the beginning you might not have much information, but as you acquire information, if a certain process goes out of control, so this is statistical process control, and you, in this case, you detect an increase from 0.5% to 0.6%, that triggers an alert and says something is going wrong here. It's not the expected complication rate for this particular procedure. And you can go after and see, is it a device? Is it a medication? Is it a type of operation that is not going well? Now, imagine we had that data much earlier. You would prevent many more of these complications if you could aggregate the data from several hospitals, from several clinics, from home countries, and perhaps worldwide. So that's what big data becomes very important. So we here at UCSD have developed models for sharing data access in a responsible manner. So you might be very familiar with this first model here. You download some data, you do some analysis, and so on. It doesn't work for clinical data. It doesn't work because it is a concern about privacy. Who can see this data, what kind of research you can do. So there are other ways to go about it. One model is to have a data center in which people come and do their computations there, so you can control very much who has access and so on. The other model that's very popular now, and we are using with several institutions, is that we create the computation, we send this computation to wherever hospitals in other countries and so on, and they come back with the answers. And you can see how that would work for the patient safety issue, because if we're having more events overall than we were predicting we would have, we have to do something about it. So the more data we aggregate and share, the sooner we can detect unsafe devices, drugs, procedures. So what we have done here, because we have all the computer science, we have the engineering, and we have the informatics groups working together is to create a privacy-protecting cloud in which we can have protected health information, identified sometimes, de-identified some other times, and compute in that cloud and allow people who have interesting models to test, who have hypotheses to develop, to invalidate, to go to the cloud and see whether they're suspicious that this particular device is unsafe if used for people with this particular condition, or if this drug, when used for people with a certain genotype, would not be safe. And we know now that even drug dosages should be adjusted according to genotype. So it's very important that we have an environment in order to test our hypotheses. What we are doing also is to use a consortium that we developed. We founded a consortium of the five University of California medical centers in order to aggregate data. So UCSD has data on about 2 million patients. We now have 12 million patients if we aggregate all the University of California medical centers. And we also have means to share it in a very responsible manner. We extended this recently in order to have the whole VA system, which is almost 9 million patients in all U.S. states and territories, to have that data computed in the same way so that we can send the computation and get answers from them, as well as safety net clinics, that's clinics serving the underserved in the Los Angeles area. So by having all of that, we have much more data in order to do our discoveries and validations. Right now, we are also developing a prototype of a new model. Currently, all your data is held by the healthcare institution, and the healthcare institution goes through every single step to protect it and share it when it is allowed to, and not share it when it's not allowed to. We believe that people have different sensitivities for privacy, and some are superstars and have a lot of at stake. Some others are regular people and just want health to get better overall. So we developed a prototype in which the patient can have more say into what data can be shared. And we are pioneering this in two clinics here at UCSD. So you as a patient can say, do I wish to disclose my data to you, which is an identified researcher in an institution? And then can I also see who looked at my data under the circumstances? And this is a model that has been very well received by several different people, different populations, because historically there has been a tremendous mismatch of those who participate in research and the overall population. We want to get to a more informed consent. Believe it or not, you can have 17 pages in order to authorize the use of your data for a certain research, and that is really difficult. So we want greater transparency in the use of data and biospecimens. We want simpler language in consent forms in a tiered consent mechanism. You may want to share parts of your record, but not other parts. That should be okay. Because patients may not know what they're sharing, and they may want to share more, may want to share less, and we have to respect this individual preferences. We developed, therefore, this prototype called iConcur, Informed Consent for Clinical Data Use for Research, in which there is more of this control, and if people want, you can also say, no, as long as you are in charge of it as an institution, I'm okay with it, which happens to be what a lot of the responses we're having now for this prototype. But we want to make sure we offer the options to people and understand why people would be reluctant or not, and that may change according to your own situation or that of a loved one. We also want to make sure we address disparities. And there are populations that have been historically excluded from research because of cultural issues or because of not being offered them, because of the myth that they wouldn't be receptive to research. So American Indian populations, African American populations with a rare disease, Kawasaki disease, Latino populations, and those who don't have insurance, these are all important individuals to be represented in research studies, and they are not currently. So it's very important that we allow more transparency. We explain what data and biospecimens will be used for and preserve the privacy. So we have a whole lot of research on privacy technology. And this is how you make this data available, but you also make it privacy for the individual patient, for the provider, and for the institution sometimes, because there's a lot about preserving the privacy of those who care and those who come for the office for being treated, but now their data can contribute to research. So this has been the work of many people, many of them who are here to be acknowledged, many students, undergraduates, graduate students, postdoctoral, and several colleagues, and primarily a lot funded by the U.S. government. So with that, I wanted to close, so since I had the privilege to be the last. You heard amazing things here today. And they all come together because they're all about predictive models, making life better, whether through climate or whether through particular direct interventions, indirect interventions in health. So I want to emphasize that what the research we do is very much impactful into what comes to you and to the ones that you care about. And with that, I want to close and come back to our host.
Lucilla, moving forward, do you think HIPAA laws will change to allow big data to help treat and prevent disease?
Yeah, I think they are already changing. There were some changes already last year. And even if they don't, if people are allowed to express their opinions, we can change the way things are being done.
For William, CitySense would be a great app to have on my phone. When will it be available to all San Diego residents?
Well, I guess if you want to fund a startup company, I think a couple of my ex-students would be glad to join that company and make it a reality. There are barriers to making this a reality soon. I think the principal one is the calibration problem I mentioned earlier. It adds a considerable expense in logistics. So basically, you're going to have to pull these sensors out of service about every 3 months. We envision maybe you'd have some sort of mail-in program where you mail in your sensor and you get a new sensor back, or you know, something like that. Remember the old days of film when you sort of mail your your pocket camera in and you get a new camera back, something like that. So it's a business model needs to be created in order to make it happen. The other challenge is it's a bootstrapping problem. Is that just getting your own personal air quality, you know, it's a start. But as I said, there are all these other scenarios where you want air quality elsewhere. So that you need a bootstrap. You need to get a certain concentration of sensors in a region in order to build that type of map. So those are the two barriers we see, and we'll see how those play out.
Thank you. Roselle, transformative cancer treatment is no longer in the future, but when will this individualized approach be available to the masses?
To some extent, I think it's available already. At least we're starting on that road. So there are several different companies that provide genomic sequencing that is CLIA grade throughout the country. And there's probably, I don't know how many thousands of patients have already been sequenced, but it is in the multi-thousands. The real problem is actually several fold. One is that a lot of doctors don't know what to do with the data. Because they haven't been trained in genomics. And another problem is that access to the drugs. So it means that you may know what drug you want to give to the patient, but the drug's approved for a different indication. And so there's a lot of regulatory hurdles that have to be overcome so that it's easily available. But as far as doing the genomic sequencing and beginning to apply it, I think that's becoming much more widespread now.
Gino, oceans are becoming more acidic. Will this affect the quality of the seafood we eat?
I think in the short term, I would say no. However, you know, in the long term, maybe not so much quality but quantity, and make things difficult in terms of fisheries. So I guess my short answer is no, but in the long term, certainly anything that's going to affect the ecosystems is going to affect our fisheries and food supplies.
Dr. Carson, is there such a thing as clean coal?
Clean coal is somewhat of an oxymoron. There clearly are some efforts underway to engage in carbon capture and sequestration by pumping it under the ground. What you find is that once you do that with a coal-fired power plant, the alternative technologies just look a lot more attractive. And that's because you're using a lot of energy and a lot of machinery to capture the carbon. And so once you have to pay that cost, you'll typically switch to something else.
This one I'll just put to the panel. Opponents of global warming include those who state that there is no hard proof of man's involvement or that increasing levels of CO2 actually cause temperature to rise. How can we put forth stronger arguments? Can we develop laboratory experiments to better support the CO2 problem?
There's some people who stick their head in the sand and hope that nothing's happening. And I mean, here I would just rely on lots of my colleagues at Scripps who are at the forefront of measuring these things. I don't think that anybody can look at these things and come to that conclusion. I think what you can come to the conclusion is that the signal is this background signal that you're getting with the carbon dioxide rising is really against a whole bunch of other things. There's the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. There's El Niño, La Niña. And you really have to layer these effects in, and they pretty much explain the anomalies that the people who want to take the position that climate change is not happening typically go for.
I'd like to address that, too. I actually think this is a great question, and I think it really goes right to the heart of how we as scientists communicate with the public. You know, I showed in my talk, and you'll see lots of talks where, you know, we present our best tools for understanding the relationship between CO2 and predicted climate change, and they all have uncertainties in them. And so I really think it's a matter of how we present that uncertainty to the public, that yes, you know, we'd have uncertainty in our climate predictions. And the linkage between climate change and anthropogenic causes is something we understand about as well as we understand any theory. I'd say the evidence is just as strong as it is for, you know, evolution or something like that. And so I think our ability to communicate that we really understand this to a very, very high degree of certainty, and also that there is uncertainty in our models, is something that's really a big task for us as scientists, and I think we really have to take it on.
So we'll just have a couple more questions for time. Dr. Kurzrock, what are the economics of individualized cancer treatment, i.e., is it affordable and doable for our medical system?
That's a question that I hear frequently, and I would say that it's absolutely affordable and doable. And what is not affordable is for us to continue to give very expensive drugs for cancer patients, as an example. A lot of our drugs are $5,000 or $10,000 per month, and because we could not select the patients, they work in about 15 to 20% of patients, and for the other 80 or 85%, they do no good or actually harm the patients. And I don't think we can afford to continue to do that. So with the personalized approach, we're going to be getting much higher response rates. We would really expect that almost everybody, as we get it right, will respond. And I think that's clearly much more affordable than what we've done and are continuing to do now.
Lucilla, your efforts related to data sharing and privacy seem thorough and transparent. Does this obviate the need for legislative action?
I would say yes, definitely. On the other hand, I would also say that our regulations are not as restrictive as some other countries that claim to be more progressive. So I would say if done right, we can go a long ways, but it has to be paired with a level of comfort from the public that this is done for protection and also allows individual preferences to be taken into account.
Okay, just two more.
Professor Alford, how important is the collection of data in the ocean from oceanographic vessels and new instruments to the study of climate change?
Did you ask this question, Walter? Well, you know, we really, you know, those of us who go to sea, it's amazing. You know, every time you actually go to sea, and we spend, you know, many of us spend about a tenth or something of our lives at sea. You every time you go to the ocean and observe it in a new way, you discover something new. And really, that's how young our science of oceanography is and how our understanding of the ocean is. You've probably heard the cliche before that we understand more about the surface of the moon than we do the seafloor. And I think that really is true. So I feel that we our ocean is critically and chronically underobserved. And you look at the differences in our predictions, our understanding of things like sea level rise before huge global arrays like the Argo system and things have come online. And they've just absolutely transformed the way that we understand the ocean and the way we can measure the ocean. So I think there's lots more advances there possible and available to us with new technology. And I'm quite optimistic that that we'll continue to make progress there.
And our final question is for Dr. Kurzrock. Do you see any connection between environmental factors such as carbon emissions and recent incidences of certain types of cancers? What sort of promise might a better understanding of the environment hold for individual cancer treatment?
So I'm not an expert on carbon emissions, so I'm going to skirt that issue. But I don't think there's any doubt that probably most cancers are some sort of interaction between the environment and hereditary components. And it's a spectrum. For some patients, it might be entirely environmental. For some patients, it might be entirely hereditary. And probably for most, it's someplace in between. And as we begin to understand that, we will better understand what factors certain people should avoid. They may be prone to, and not just for cancer too, I think it's for general health. People may be more prone to heart disease or any of a set number of diseases, and they can modify that depending on their genetics and therefore modify both their environment and understand their actual propensity to disease.
Well, on that note, I have a 102-year-old client, and so what do you ask a 102-year-old? Right? How did you make it to 102? And this is his answer. I didn't drink, smoke, tell dirty jokes, or go with the girls who did. With a twinkle in his eye, because it's all genetics. I'm telling you, it's all genetics with him. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it. We hope you were inspired. Thank you to our wonderful panelists here. Fascinating talks, all of you. Very different, but connected. Very informative. If we didn't get to your question, if you'd like to learn more, go to the Founders Symposium website. It's founders.ucsd.edu, and you can learn more about our speakers here tonight. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.